Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as always, some very interesting economic U.S. and global news of the past week that we're going to address here. Maybe the most important was the Federal Reserve interviews of Federal Reserve Chairman Powell with Congress. And the Trump response to the Fed raising interest rates going forward. Kind of lost in the whole cacophony of trade issues here, right? The other issue being Trump's indicating he was going to slap tariffs on European autos. That's part of his rhetoric of trade wars, right? We'll talk about, you know, is there really a trade war going on? Well, you know, I've been saying all along that a lot of it is smoke and mirrors. If you look at the figures, the U.S. Imports about $3 trillion every year and exports about $2.58 trillion. So it runs the deficit of close to $500 billion a year. Break that over 12 months, you know, you're looking at a 40, 50, sometimes a little bit larger trade deficit. That trade deficit, by the way, has been slowing, has been shrinking every month. So it's not as if it's getting worse. But it's Trump's target. The trade deficit is his target to resurrect his economic nationalist appeal that won him the 2016 election once again, because he's running again, of course. He hasn't stopped running for re-election. And, you know, the immediate goal for him is the November midterm elections. He's got to have Republicans win that election for him to carry through the rest of his neoliberal 2.0 policy regime. So, you know, the first part of that policy regime was massive tax cuts, always part of neoliberalism. $5 trillion, as I've been saying over and over again, not $1.5, $5 trillion of tax cuts to investors, business, corporations, and wealthy 1%. $2 trillion increase in taxes for the rest of us, which will hit next year, you see, after the November elections, not this year. Republicans are very clever about that. And then some phony estimates about U.S. economic growth, which reduce it from a net $3 trillion tax cuts to $1.5 trillion tax cuts. Well, you know, now the Republicans are saying, oh, we need more tax cuts. Yeah, another $1.5 trillion in the pipeline in Congress. They're going to make the Trump tax cuts permanent, meaning the 10 years of these tax cuts are not enough for businesses and the wealthy. Let's make them permanent. Plus, they're going to pass some new tax cuts here for startups and pension funds and so forth. Okay, so, you know, more tax cuts coming for the rich. It's not the end. And more defense spending coming for the war establishment in the United States. His increase in defense war spending, basically $75 billion for this year and next. But that's only part of it. It's only Pentagon, you see, because if you talk about defense spending, you got to talk about Homeland Security. You got to talk about Atomic Energy Commission, the Energy Department, veterans, and so forth. All of that and interest on the debt of all that. That's all part of really the war defense establishment spending here. And that's about $1 trillion a year. Well, he's upped at $75 billion for the next 2 years, but more is coming. More is coming. A lot more is coming. So, you know, we have neoliberalism, fiscal policy, tax cutting for the rich and more spending, you know, two foundations of neoliberal policy, which ends up redistributing a lot of income to the wealthy and their corporations, their conduits of wealth distribution to them. through share buybacks and dividend payouts, which, you know, as I've also said, are now well over $1 trillion a year. Under Obama, they were about $1 trillion a year for 6 years, but now they've exceeded $1 trillion, the buybacks and the dividend payouts. That's where a lot of the $5 trillion is going, you see. It's going into buybacks and going into dividend payouts to boost stock prices of the wealthy, once again. But there's some signs that all these buybacks, they have to buy back and spend more on stocks and bonds because the effect is dissipating in terms of stock prices and so forth. That's why they're upping it, to keep that stock market up there, you see. Okay, so, you know, trade policy should be viewed as a response or a reflection of these new neoliberal policy regimes. Well, not new. This is just Trump is neoliberalism 2.0, you see, much more aggressive, violent policy. Obama was not able to reestablish the neoliberal regime after 2008. It still sputtered, but here comes Trump now, and he's putting it back on track. It's a more virulent form of neoliberal policy. Of course, the hallmarks being war defense spending and tax cuts for the rich and deregulation of businesses, which saves them money as well, privatization of social programs and so forth. All that is neoliberalism, established a new policy mix regime established under Reagan and been evolving ever since. And you have to realize that what you've got here under Trump is, you know, an attempt to reestablish this. And he's doing it quite well. Okay, and the whole trade thing is a reflection of the trade element response to neoliberalism. Right, that's what Trump is doing. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, free trade is the essential element of neoliberal trade policy, free trade agreements, but the multilateral approaches to free trade, up until Trump, we're not delivering what big business really wanted, a certain wing of it anyway. A part of the traditional wing of corporate America doesn't want to shake the boat, but another part wants to shake the boat. And Trump says, I'm going to shake the boat, and we're going to have bilateral free trade deals. You see, he's a free trader. I've been saying this in writing even before he was elected. Trump is a free trader. He's just a bilateral free trader. He says, I can do better. Let's break up these or renegotiate these multilateral deals like NAFTA, TPP, and so forth, TTIP. Let's negotiate one-on-one. I'm a great negotiator, right? The art of the deal. And I'm going to get a better deal. And in the meantime, he uses it all as a ideological appeal to his base for economic nationalism. So that's where the whole trade thing fits. My next forthcoming book is The Scourge of Neoliberalism, From Reagan to Trump. So it's an analysis not only of the fiscal and monetary side, but the trade side of this, the money flow side, the international capitalist money flow, investment flow side of this, which is often missed in a lot of accounts of neoliberalism. That comes out later this year. But we'll be talking about some of the elements of it as we talk about the trade offensive here that's going on. Well, let's get back to, on this trade thing, is there really a trade war going on? Well, not yet. We're on the cusp of it, maybe, but not yet. As I said earlier, U.S. imports, total imports, $3 trillion. Imports into the U.S., right? Exports from the U.S., $2.5 trillion a year, annually. Well, how much of this $3 trillion, $3.06 trillion, in fact, has Trump imposed tariffs on? Actual tariffs, you see. You got to distinguish when you listen to this trade war rhetoric, which is really hyped by the media. you got to distinguish between announcements of I will do this if you don't play ball with me. Between just the rhetoric of free trade or trade war, distinguish that from the actual announcement of tariffs, and distinguish the announcement of tariffs from the actual implementation of tariffs. There's been a lot of announcements, you see. Oh, 50 billion here, 200 billion there, 100 billion here, right? That's all pre-negotiation hoopla. What counts is what are the actual tariffs implemented. And if you look at the United States, out of $3 trillion plus of imports to the U.S., Trump has only implemented $72 billion of actual tariffs. You know, about $32 billion here on steel tariffs, $36 billion on China, and about $3 to $4 billion on solar tariffs and appliances and so forth at the beginning of this year. All right, so that's only 2.3% of total U.S. imports to the U.S. 2.3%. Well, you know, is that a trade war? Is that a trade war? Only 2.3%? I don't think so. Doesn't sound to it to me that that's a trade war. Yeah, that's sort of a preliminary. It could get significant if Trump actually, for example, imposed $200 billion more tariffs on China than implemented. Then you would be in a trade war with China. He would never do that with the allies, you see. Allies meaning NAFTA and Japan and Europe. But he might do that with China. Well, if that should happen, then we would be in a trade war. But we're not. Only $36 billion. You know, he had proposed $50 billion initially, and he's only implemented $36 billion. Well, the Chinese are responding tit for tat with $36 billion, $34, $36 billion, right? So, you know, that's the policy of China, to just sort of not escalate, let the U.S. escalate it. Well, if you look at what are the responses of China and NAFTA countries, Mexico and Canada, right, and the EU, Europe, it's also 2.3% of the $2.58 trillion of U.S. exports to those countries and regions. 2.3%, about $60 billion. On 2.58 trillion of U.S. exports. So the U.S. has imposed only 2.3% tariffs on the 3 trillion imports coming to the U.S., and China, Europe, and NAFTA have imposed 2.3% on the 2.58 trillion exports from the U.S. to those countries. 2.3%, right? I mean, that's not a trade war. That's a trade maneuver, right? They're maneuvering here. And what's it really all about? I think it's mostly about U.S. domestic politics here, especially with the allies. Allies meaning Mexico, Canada, Japan, Europe. A lot of hyperbole going on, and warnings that it could slip into a trade war. My predictions are the following. I think there'll be a deal with NAFTA by year end. In fact, they already had a deal a couple months ago, and Trump blew it up. Oh, too soon. He wants a deal closer to the November elections so he can go to his political base saying, oh, look what I did. You know, all these, you know, Mexico and Canada really abusing us. Look, I got this and that and so forth. And of course, he'll lie and exaggerate the details. Right. Make it look like he's doing something to these foreigners, you see. They're to blame for all the problems. It's not just immigrants. It's the capitalist foreigners that he's targeting as well. Okay, so I think there'll be a NAFTA deal right before or after the election. All right, he may have to wait for López Obrador to come into office, but Mexico is going to line it all up here before Lopez Obrador comes on, and I don't see a big change in Lopez Obrador policies. He's kind of like the Mexican Obama, right? A lot of promises, a lot of talk, but once he gets into office, what does he do? He appoints capitalist advisors to run his economic program. Yeah, just as Obama did, and nothing really changed. You know, there were some token things to try to get the economy going again, and Lopez Obrador will do that. But there'd be no real significant change in Mexico policies. You know, he'll throw a few crumbs at pensioners and at students, but no significant change from the real wealth that is made and grabbed by the top 1% in Mexico and, of course, the U.S. investors in Mexico. Okay, so he'll wait for Lopez Obrador. But a deal has already been crafted, you know. It's like 95% done with Mexico and Canada. You know, Mexico has only imposed $3 billion of tariffs on U.S. imports into Mexico. Only $3 billion. That's nothing. Canada, a little bit more, about $12 billion. You know, you got $1 trillion or more of trade between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, and we're talking about, you know, $15 billion total. I mean, that's nothing. Oh, but if you listen to the media, it really sounds like, oh, we're in a big trade war. Well, it's something that they can really hype and sell. Excuse me. And it also plays well for the Eastern U.S. elite that's trying to go after Trump in every way it can, trying to make it look like Trump is really crazy. He may be. But, you know, they hype anything negative they can. So, in short, right? I don't believe there's yet a trade war. There could very well be. And if there is one, it'll be with China, you see, because the U.S. wants three things from China in the trade war or trade negotiations. What they want is more access to markets in China, which is a way of saying U.S. companies want majority ownership, 51% or even 100% of their operations in China, you know. Until recently, they can only have 49%. Well, China already told them, you got it. You got the 51, and you can have the 100. You know, we're open to that. Well, that's what Steve Mnuchin and U.S. bankers want, you see. He represents on the trade negotiating team, Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, ex-Goldman Sachser. You know, he represents the banks who want to get in there and multinational corporations that want to have more control of their operations. And they love it. And at one point, Mnuchin even said, yeah, we got a deal. This is great. But there's more than just the big banker, big multinational corporation faction on the U.S. trade team. There's also the agricultural base, Trump's agricultural Midwest base, which wants the Chinese to buy more agricultural goods, you see, not just soybeans, but a lot of other stuff. And China has already said publicly, yeah, we'll buy $100 billion more. Well, that will go a long way to reducing the trade deficit with China that Trump says is the issue. Goods trade deficit. You know, the U.S. runs a trade services surplus with China. They don't say that very much, but it does. You know, China has made concessions on two big broad fronts, more access to its markets and more purchases of U.S. Agricultural and Midwest goods. The big stumbling block with the deal with China, of course, is technology. China last year put out this China 2025, as I've said before, vision, where it wants to be the leader in new technologies like artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, and 5G wireless. Well, those have big military implications to them. You know, China could leapfrog the U.S. militarily if it takes the lead in this area. And that's got the U.S. defense establishment quite worried. right? I mean, the Pentagon and the spook agencies and so forth, and their friends in Congress. And what they want is to do something about tech transfer. You see, China, in pursuing this 2025, requires U.S. corporations in China doing business there to share their technology. And China has also been on a binge to try to purchase high-tech companies in the U.S. and Europe. And that involves tech transfer as well. Well, the U.S. wants to stop that, you see. And there's a third, that third faction on the U.S. negotiating team, led by Lighthizer, Robert Lighthizer and Peter Navarro. And at first, they almost got a deal with China back in May. Mnuchin almost closed the deal for the market access that he wants, but it was stymied by Congress. The defense establishment folks did an end run around Trump and the negotiating team. Mnuchin and went through their friends in Congress, and the big test case was the ZTE Corporation, and they pulled the strings on that. And you know, China is vulnerable in that China imports a lot of its chips, and indirectly comes from the U.S. That's a big vulnerability for China in these negotiations. ZTE Corporation was purchasing a lot of chips and other tech equipment. ZTE is a telecom company, which is a high-tech company. And the warning shot across China's bow here was the banning of ZTE doing any work in the U.S. Well, that was a U.S. Defense faction move here through Congress. Trump and Congress came to a tentative agreement on that, and ZTE was allowed back in and so forth. But what you see on the Trump team now is more of a focus on and raising the issue of the tech transfer issue. They sometimes call that intellectual property, you see, because it's software. So that fight within the U.S. factions continues. And what's happening now is President Xi of China is just sitting back and waiting to see what happens here. Waiting to see what happens. He's not going to jump, and there's not that much negotiations going on. Xi wants to wait until November to see how things shake out. November in the U.S., right? Right. China has some other tactics it can employ in this so-called run-up to a trade war, or in a trade war. One thing it can do is slow down its purchase of U.S. Treasuries, which the U.S. now must sell more than ever. It's got to sell more and more treasuries because of this massive deficit, $1 trillion a year plus, that Trump has created with his tax cuts and his defense war spending hikes. So Xi is waiting for that, and you know, they could slow down. Not likely they're going to do that. More likely is another weapon they have is to allow their currency, the yuan, to devalue. It's already devalued about 10% since the beginning of the year. In other words, you can't ignore currency moves in relationship to tariffs, right? The U.S. could impose a 10% tariff on China, which would make Chinese goods less competitive by 10%, all things equal. But China could then respond and reduce the value of its currency by 10% and offset that, you see. So these trade wars and tariff wars tend to eventually lead to currency wars, and we're on the verge of that. Right. And that's what's got some people very, you know, big capitalist policymakers upset. It's not so much the trade and the tariffs, which, you know, as I've said, is minimal so far everywhere. A lot of talk, but minimal actual implementation. It's what it could precipitate in terms of currency devaluations and competitive currency wars. You see, that upsets everything. All holders of assets get whacked. when you have currency wars and currency devaluations, competitive currency devaluations. If it's tariffs, well, then only those industries affected by tariffs get whacked. But all the capitalists get whacked when there's a currency war. And that's what they're really concerned about. The yuan is already trading at the very edge of its trading band, right? They tend to keep it between, I think it's 6.1 and 6.8 to the dollar, right? A fixed trading trading band there. But it's already at 6.8. And if it breaks through that band, well, then you're going to see not only a devaluation of the Chinese currency, but you're going to see a spillover effect everywhere, especially in emerging markets. All the rest are going to respond. All the rest of the economies will respond to reduce their currencies as well to remain competitive in terms of exports and imports. The problem with collapsing currencies is that investors don't want to hold the currency that's falling in value because it just, on paper, wipes out their profits. So what they do is they sell the currencies when they're declining and they buy dollars because dollars are safe and dollars are going up. The value of the dollar is going up. Why? Because interest rates are going up in the U.S. Why are interest rates going up? Because deficits and debt are going up. You got to pay for it somehow. You got to borrow it somehow. So the Fed raises interest rates to entice more borrowers of Federal Reserve bills, notes, and bonds. So you see, these things are all linked. But the big destabilizer going on is the Fed rate hikes. But the Fed rate hikes are necessary for the Fed in order to finance the huge deficit. It has nothing to do with the economy growing, because it really isn't. A lot of smoke and mirrors on U.S. GDP. And U.S. consumption is about to take another hit in terms of real wage income. You know, the Federal Reserve just reported, 2.9% inflation rate here. Well, in the 2 point wages have gone up about 2.1%, right? So in real terms, wages are going down. Yes, in 2018, real wages are going down. And it's actually not just a question of inflation rate, why it's going, real wages are going down. This 2.1% is only for full-time permanent employees, you see. It says nothing about the lack of wage growth for the 50 million plus people who are contingent workers, part-time, temp, etc., on call, right? Their wages aren't going up 2.1%. No. So you have to adjust it. And it's really an average also. Another criticism is the 2.1% is an average, meaning it's skewed to the top. People on top wage structure, you know, making 100,000 a year, you know, software engineers and so forth, right? They're getting maybe 3-4%, and the rest are getting far less. So you get an average of 2.1. So it's only permanent full-time employees, and it's only an average, not a median. And it's not real. It's nominal, and it was not adjusted for inflation. So, you know, you make all those adjustments for inflation, for averages, and real time, and permanent full-time work, and so forth, and you get a wage increase for the median worker, $45,000 a year income, that's almost stagnant. It's not growing at all. Oh, well, why are they still consuming? Well, because they're borrowing more, you see. Yeah, we've been financing consumption through debt now for decades. So when the next recession comes, those folks are going to be in even deeper trouble than ordinarily. consumption will contract even more in the next recession than it did in the last, perhaps. Okay, so that's the picture of consumption and GDP in the U.S. and which brings us to what happened this past week. The Fed, Powell says he's going to continue raising interest rates. You know, he's already raised them twice this year. He's going to raise them two more times, you see. They're at about 2%, the federal funds benchmark rates at 2%. And two more times, a quarter percent each, two more times, and what you got is 2.5%. I've been saying all along that if you go above 2.5%, it may be 2.75, maybe 3, but certainly you're in dangerous territory for an interest rate precipitated recession. And we're coming to that. If the Fed keeps raising rates above 2.5% here, it could precipitate the next recession. Rates in 2006-07 went up to 5.25%. And that precipitated the crash, you see. Precipitated, didn't cause it, precipitated it. Well, now it won't take 5.25. I believe it'll take about half of that, or 2.753, certainly. Why? Because the economy and households and businesses are in further debt than they were back in 2007. We've increased U.S. Total debt by over $20 trillion since the 2009-10 crisis. $20 trillion more. And that means that I won't go through the mechanisms, but that means that we're going to have a precipitated contraction even before we get nowhere near 5.25%, nowhere near. And I continue to argue somewhere between 2.5-3% is what the problem is, the threshold for another contraction coming. Now, you can see this reflected in concern about what's called the yield curve, right? What's the yield curve? We've talked about that a little bit. The yield curve is the gap between short-term and long-term interest rates, usually reflected in the two-year Treasury note and the 10-year Treasury bond, right? The difference between them. Well, right now, the two-year Treasury note is 2.45 or something like that, and the 10-year bond is only 0.25 above it. Right? We only have a 0.25% gap between them. You know, the curve here is if you draw a line out for the changes in these two interest rates here, you get a line and another line for the two-year and the 10-year, and they curve. In other words, the 10-year slows or doesn't grow as fast or declines, and the two-year grows faster or declines slower than the 10-year. And you get a conversion or an inversion, even when the two curves actually converge, right? That's called an inverted yield curve. And sometimes you even have the 10-year dropping below, paying less than the 2-year, right? The 10-year is reflected by a market and investors and the economy saying, "Oh, the economy is going to slow." The two-year is when the Fed doesn't believe that and keeps raising rates, you see. So you get a yield curve inversion when the Fed takes action contrary to what the greater, larger economy believes is the economic condition. Well, why would the Fed do that? Why would the Fed raise rates when the rest of investors in the economy say, no, this economy is weaker than you're saying, Fed. The Fed raises rates because it says, oh, the economy is going too hot, you see. And the rest of the world says, no, it's not, you know. And the Fed bucks the trend. Well, why would the Fed buck the trend? Because the Fed's got to raise $1 trillion to pay for the Trump deficits and debt. That's why. It's not raising rates because of the economy is too strong. It's raising rates to pay for the deficits and debt. And that's risky, because at some point, you keep raising the rates, you precipitate a contraction. That's where we are right now, you see. That's why I believe if the Fed raises above 2.75 by 2019, because it says it's going to raise rates three more times in 2019 on top of the four this year, right? So if it does that, you know, and the economy is not as strong, then what you're going to have is a credit crunch. Well, what's that? Well, when rates are too high, businesses can't borrow or won't borrow to continue to expand. And those who are already on shaky ground, businesses not doing very well, the banks won't loan them money because they can't pay it back. So the businesses that need it the most don't get the loans to keep paying the interest and principal on their prior debt, which is too much. They can't roll over that debt. They can't get the loans, right? And they go bankrupt. And that's a reflection of the crisis as well. Well, what are the businesses most likely to not get loans at the higher rates to roll over their debt? And how much debt do they got coming? Well, if you look at the junk bond market in the U.S., it's a high debt. In other words, high interest rates, right? Because these are companies that are high risk. They pay higher interest rates. Well, they got trillions of dollars coming due in the next couple of years. Coming due meaning they got to roll it over, refinance it. Right? If rates keep going up, they'll never be able to get the loans to refinance it, in which case they go under. And it's not just in the U.S., a big trouble spot is Asia. Asian junk bond debt, you might say. You might call it that. Right? In Asia, you know, a report just recently came out that showed that Asian junk debt, is very high and very risky, and there's trillions of dollars that needs to be refinanced in the next coming year or two. A lot of that's in China, but of course the Chinese government has a lot of resources and can cope with that. But the other Asian economies don't. And there's a very high amount of debt, what we call the junk bond debt, in Asia. And they might not be able to roll it over. Well, are interest rates rising there? Yes, they're rising everywhere, you see, because all of the central banks follow the U.S. Federal Reserve eventually. If the Fed raises interest rates, it raises the value of the dollar, which is rising. And that means the currencies of these other countries are falling. And that means investors may pull their money out of those countries unless their domestic central banks raise their rates too, which they do to keep the money capital from flowing out. But by raising interest rates in, you know, in Argentina and Brazil and places like that, Indonesia, it means that they're going to slow their domestic economy. To protect the value of their currency, they slow their domestic economy. And of course, that has consequences. Okay, so that's what's going on now. It's a very fluid situation globally, and there's increasing financial trouble spots beginning to appear. Asian bonds are one. In the U.S., it's not just junk bonds, but it's now what's called, which were considered safer, investment-grade bonds. But the less safe of investment grade bonds are called triple B bonds. Well, they're kind of becoming a kind of like a junk bond, you see. So the amount of debt that's more risky has been growing in the U.S. as well as globally as well. Okay. And that's why Trump this past week came out in an unprecedented response to Powell, who is being interviewed by Congress, and said he's still on track for two more rate hikes this year and more next year. Well, Trump's worried now. Trump's worried that these rate hikes will slow his economic growth before the November election, and certainly before he runs again for office in 2020. He's not, presidents aren't supposed to do this, you see. The central bank is supposed to be, quote, independent, unquote, from presidents. Well, they're not independent from the banking system through their friends in Congress and the banking committees. The big banks have a lot of influence over the longer-term strategic decisions of the Federal Reserve. Not the day-to-day necessarily, but the longer-term. Like the decision to raise rates here a couple of years ago and to sell off the $4.5 trillion balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. That comes after discussion with the banks, you see. That's how they do it. Because the banks have a lot of influence over the what's called the FOMC, the market committee that determines interest rate directions in the Federal Reserve. It's made up of 19 people, and those people are the majority of them, two-thirds, come from the presidents of the Federal Reserve districts in the U.S. There's 12 of them, and those Federal Reserve districts presidents are selected by an internal committee in each, in which the bankers have three representatives and other corporations three representatives and the public three. So the bankers and their corporate friends control the district feds by that two-thirds vote, you see, and they always make sure that their presidents are pro-banker, pro-business. And then the presidents sit on the Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC, 12 of the 19, right? So they have that influence, you know, from the bottom up still within the Federal Reserve. Right? And, you know, what you got here is Trump saying, well, you're going to scuttle my whole recovery as weak as it is. By the way, it'll be probably the next GDP numbers will show a pretty good, robust growth. But GDP is not really reflective of the real condition of the economy anymore. GDP numbers, you know. You got a lot of people employed, but no wage growth. No wage growth at all. What's important is not that people have jobs, but they have jobs that have money that they can spend. You see, you don't go from jobs to consumption. You go from jobs to wage incomes and incomes and then consumption. So if you add jobs but you're not growing wages or incomes, what's the effect on consumption? Well, keep borrowing, friends, and maybe you can keep the ship afloat. But how much can you borrow? And when you have a recession, you can't borrow anymore, you see, and that's when things really collapse. Right? People go bankrupt. Okay, so we see a slowing global economy going on. And don't believe the IMF forecast and the World Bank forecast, because if you look at the last 20 years, they always over-forecast, you know, by at least 25%. Estimation of projected growth rates, right? And they're always adjusting it after the fact. They're always overly optimistic. But even so, there are reports, you know, that the growth is slowing. Global trade is slowing. Is it because of trade wars? They'll have you believe so, but no, it's because of rising interest rates and debt. That's why it's slowing. And you should think of this these trade wars as a capital intercapitalist response to the projected long-run slowing of global trade. Each side is trying to protect its share of the global trade pie, you see, at the expense of somebody else. That's another way of looking at, quote, the trade wars. You know, periodically the U.S. Restructures, whenever global trade seems to sputter, restructures it, because it has the power to do so, to its advantage. Nixon did it in 1971-73, targeting the Europeans who were beginning to cut into U.S. Markets. The outcome was a devaluation of the dollar and tax hikes, tariffs on imports to the U.S., and tax cuts for U.S. corporations, especially autos. So this combination of taxes and tariffs go hand in hand. You know, we saw that in the 70s when there was a crisis. We saw it again in the mid-1980s under Reagan. This time, the target was Japan, not Europe. Europe secondarily. U.S. restructured as part of a trade deal, restructured the relationship, you know, trade deficits and so forth with Japan. And now we see it again in another crisis here coming out of 2008-09. Obama couldn't do it, and now Trump is restructuring trade relationships to put U.S. capitalists back in the driver's seat for another decade vis-a-vis their challengers, whether those challengers be Europe or NAFTA or China, China in particular. They're restructuring the capitalist global trading system. Whether Trump can pull this off a third time here and replicate Reagan and Nixon's efforts remains to be seen. I think it'll be a lot tougher for Trump to do it because the U.S. had a lot more influence over Japan in the 80s than the U.S. has over China today. We'll see what happens. But you got to put this in historical context, you see. Restructuring of the global economy is something the U.S. has repeatedly done. It did it right after World War II, right, when it was the only game in town, to its advantage, created the IMF, created the World Bank, created the dollar as the global trading and reserve currency. And that worked until the 1970s, and the U.S. and global economy began to stagnate. So we got another restructuring coming out of that, and that's called neoliberalism under Ronald Reagan. But that is getting long in the tooth. You know? And Obama couldn't put it back together again. So now, as I said at the beginning of the show, we've got neoliberalism 2.0 with Trump, a more virulent, aggressive against domestic challengers, you know, unions and workers and so forth, and particularly against foreign capitalist competitors. More virulent form of neoliberalism, more aggressive. And that's how you should understand Trump policy and understand that trade is a reflection of the fiscal monetary policies of neoliberalism. They all go hand in hand. That's why the trade restructuring always follows the tax and the war spending restructuring, you see. And that's where we are right now. You know, Trump got his put neoliberal policy back on its feet in terms of tax, more tax cuts for the rich and corporations, more defense spending, you know, for the defense establishment. And now he's turning this year to trade as a supplement to it all. Next year, he will turn, I predict, to massive attempt to engineer massive cuts in social spending, particularly Social Security, Medicare, education. That's coming, right? But they can't do this all at once, you see. But this is like the second shoe, the trade policy that's dropping here this year. They'll come to the third next year. They don't also don't want to take on social spending of these programs before the November elections, you see. They'll wait till after the November elections to roll that out. But it's all part of control and extracting more profitability out of domestic economy and out of the global economy. There are warnings from the OECD, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the statistic arm of the advanced economies, from the Bank of International Settlements, and even J.P. Morgan Chase, that the global economy is not in that great a shape. Right? And we see the devaluation of the yuan going on, and by the way, Chinese stock market contraction going on. Looks in some ways a little bit like 2015 when the stock market crashed there. We got Asian junk bonds that I talked about. We got some of the shadow banks that are raising warnings that, people withdrawing their money from us. What's going on here? The savvy investors know that they're at the end of the business cycle and the profits aren't going to keep flowing, and they're taking their money and moving it to the sidelines. An important indicator of slowing global economy, perhaps one of the best, is the fact that the metals prices are going south, are declining, especially copper. See, copper is necessary for industrial production. And if the demand for copper is slowing and the prices, therefore, are falling for copper, it's an indication that the global economy is about to slow down and trade is about to slow down, right? We have interest rates around the world following U.S. rates up, the federal funds rate. That's another indicator. We got emerging market currencies declining as the dollar goes up and the rates go up. As I said, we have signs of trouble in China. In the U.S., commercial real estate is in free fall. Commercial real estate being building of plants and malls and factories and office buildings and so forth, right? Reflecting. It's always an early responder to rising rates. We'll see housing market continue to do that. Although prices for residential housing are kept up because of foreign demand flowing in for housing. As the money leaves emerging market economies in China, it flows to real estate, you see, in the advanced economies in Canada, in the U.S., Australia, Europe. Another indicator is what's called the Baltic Dry Index, down 22% since the beginning of the year. What is that? That's an index that shows the volume of world trade being shipped around the world. Okay, so that's slowing down. Copper price is slowing down. Global Purchasing Managers Indexes down 10 to 15% since January. Export volumes slowing down. In other words, the global trading world, the volume of global trade is slowing, and it's not because of trade wars. Trade wars are a response to that slowing, not vice versa. You know, what's the causal relationship here? It's not that trade is causing the slowdown. It's that the slowdown is causing conflicts over trade, right? And the U.S. is maneuvering to restructure itself so it protects itself from the slowdown that's coming. And with the slowdown in trade will come the slowing of GDP, especially in these economies around the world, smaller countries that are like 30, 40, 50% dependent on exports and trade. Even Germany, highly dependent, almost half of its GDP on exports and trade. By the way, German economy, for the first time, looks like it's getting very shaky for a long time here. And as Germany goes, so does Europe. Well, Europe is barely growing 1% GDP, and that's an overestimation. Japan is already in recession. The UK is growing about a half of 1%, and they're raising interest rates everywhere around the world because they got to in response to the U.S. raising rates. You see, the raising of the rates drives up the dollar, and therefore the rates of all the other countries around the world to protect their currencies from devaluing too much. So the Fed drives global interest rates. And as the Fed raises rates, it drives the dollar and global currencies. But why is the Fed raising rates? Again, it comes to the deficits and the debt. That's why. To finance the deficits and the debt. U.S. capitalists are fattening their wallets with subsidies from tax cuts and government spending on war and defense, right? In the short term, they're fattening their wallets. But they're shooting themselves in the foot in the longer term. But they don't care. As long as they make their money now, they'll take it and run. And when a problem occurs globally, they'll stuff it under the mattress. They look at the profits now. Yeah, they like to make sure they can keep it going. But if they can make super profits now, they'll do it. And, of course, the tax cuts gave an immediate boost of 25% at least to the bottom lines of major U.S. corporations. 25%. They didn't do anything for 25%. It was all the government, the state, that did it for them. Boosted their profits 25% after they had made record profits for 6 years. And what are they doing with all those profits, that 25% boost? Well, they're pumping it into stock buybacks and dividend payouts to keep their stock prices up, you see. Because that's how most CEOs are evaluated here by their boards, by what's happening with the stock prices. Right. So to keep the money flowing short term, with tax cuts and excess spending by the government, they're producing these huge deficits and debt, causing the Fed to have to raise interest rates to sell $1 trillion-plus bonds every year. Well, I think the Fed just offered to sell like $100 billion here this past week. I forget exactly what it was in an auction. Yeah, huge amounts. So you got Trump then complaining to the Fed, don't raise interest rates. Well, after you created these deficits and debt that requires the Fed to raise interest rates. Because raising interest rates has nothing to do with a 2% inflation target. That's a fiction that the Federal Reserve has maintained for decades. It's not about that at all. Right now, it's about selling bonds, offering it at a high enough price that you can attract $1 trillion. And that's wrecking the U.S. and the global economy in the medium term. Yeah, they're flying high right now, but they won't be able to for very much longer. That's why I'm predicting 2019 recession. If the Fed raises rates another 50 basis points, in other words, twice, 0.25%, it's well over 250, you're going to see a precipitated credit drying up. And all these companies that are overextended in households with their debt will not be able to reborrow in order to keep paying their debt. And you're going to see business bankruptcies, particularly those who are in BBB investment grade debt over their head and junk bond debt over their head. Okay, next week, I'm sure we'll have some interesting news to continue. Walk the streets, they're screaming now.